butter for her and bread and marmalade, and we're all outlaws now. Frankie was the first outlaw till we went raiding for coal all over Limerick. Jar Dennehy looks interested and takes Michael downstairs by the hand, and in a few minutes we hear him laughing. Aunt Aggie says, "That's a disgraceful way to behave with my mother sick in the bed." The guard comes back and tells her, "Go for a doctor." He keeps covering his face with his cap whenever he looks at me or my brothers. "Desperados," he says, "desperados." The doctor comes with Aunt Aggie in his motor car, and he has to rush my mother to the hospital with her pneumonia. We'd all like to go riding in the doctor's car, but Aunt Aggie says, "No, ye are all coming to my house till your mother comes home from the hospital." I tell her not to bother. I'm 11, and I can easily look after my brothers. I'd be glad to stay at home from school and make sure everyone is fed and washed. But Grandma screams I will do no such thing, and Aunt Aggie gives me a thump for myself. Gard Dennehy says I'm too young yet to be an outlaw and a father, but I have a promising future in both departments. "Get your clothes," says Aunt Aggie. "You're coming to my house till your mother is out of the hospital. Jesus above, that baby is a disgrace." She finds a rag and ties it around Alfie's bottom for fear he might shit all over the pram. Then she looks at us and wants to know why we're standing there with our faces hanging out after she told us to get our clothes. I'm afraid she'll hit me or yell at me when I tell her it's all right, we have our clothes, they're on us. She stares at me and shakes her head. "Here," she says, "put some sugar and water in the child's bottle." She tells me I have to push Alfie through the streets. She can't manage the pram with that bockety wheel that makes it rock back and forth. And besides, 'tis a disgraceful-looking object she'd be ashamed to put a mangy dog in. She takes the three old coats from our bed and piles them on the pram till you can hardly see Alfie at all. Grandma comes with us and barks at me all the way from Roden Lane to Aunt Aggie's flat in Windmill Street. "Can't you push that pram properly? Jesus, you're going to kill that child. Stop going from side to side or I'll give you a good clitter on the gob." She won't come into Aunt Aggie's flat. She can't stand the sight of us one more minute. She's fed up with the whole McCourt clan from the days when she had to send 6 fares to bring us all back from America, dishing out more money for funerals for dead children, giving us food every time our father drank the dole or the wages, helping Angela carry on while that blackguard from the north drinks his wages all over England. Oh, she's fed up, so she is. And off she goes across Henry Street with her black shawl pulled up around her white head, limping along in her black, high-lace boots. When you're 11 and your brothers are 10, 5 and 1, you don't know what to do when you go to someone's house, even if she's your mother's sister. You're told to leave the pram in the hall and bring the baby into the kitchen. But if it's not your house, you don't know what to do once you get into the kitchen for fear the aunt will yell at you or hit you on the skull. She takes off her coat and takes it to the bedroom, and you stand with the baby in your arms waiting to be told. If you take one step forward or one step to the side, she might come out and say, "Where are you going?" And you don't know what to answer because you don't know yourself. If you say anything to your brothers, she might say, "Who do you think you're talking to in my kitchen?" We have to stand and be quiet, and that's hard when there's a tinkling sound from the bedroom, and we know she's on the chamber pot peeing away. I don't want to look at Malachy. If I do, I'll smile, and he'll smile, and Michael will smile, and there's danger we'll start laughing, and if we do, we won't be able to stop for days at the picture in our heads of Aunt Aggie's big white bum perched on a flowery little chamber pot. I'm able to control myself. I won't laugh. Malachy and Michael won't laugh. And it's easy to see we're all proud of ourselves for not laughing and getting into trouble with Aunt Aggie, till Alfie in my arms smiles and says, "Goo goo," and that sets us off. The three of us burst out laughing, and Alfie grins with his dirty face and says goo goo again, till we're helpless, and Aunt Aggie roars out of the room, pulling her dress down, and gives me a thump on the head that sends me against the wall, baby and all. She hits Malachi too, and she tries to hit Michael, but he runs to the other side of her round table, and she can't get at him. "Come over here," she says, "and I'll wipe that grin off your puss." But Michael keeps running around the table, and she's too fat to catch him. "I'll get you later," she says. "I'll warm your arse." "And you, Lord Muck," she says to me, "put that child down on the floor over there by the range." She puts the old coats from the pram on the floor, and Alfie lies there with his sugary water and says goo goo and smiles. She tells us, "Take off every scrap of our clothes. Get out to the tap in the backyard and scrub every inch of our bodies. We are not to come back into this house till we're spotless." I want to tell her it's the middle of February. It's freezing outside. We could all die. But I know if I open my mouth, I might die right there on the kitchen floor. We're out in the yard, naked, dousing ourselves with icy water from the tap. She opens the kitchen window and throws out a scrub brush and a big bar of brown soap like the one they used on Finn the horse. She orders us to scrub each other's backs, and don't stop till she tells us. Michael says his hands and feet are falling off with the cold, but she doesn't care. She keeps telling us we're still dirty, and if she has to come out to scrub us, we'll rue the day. Another rue. I scrub myself harder. We all scrub till we're pink and our jaws chatter. It's not enough for Aunt Aggie. She comes out with the bucket and sloshes cold water all over us. "Now," she says, "get inside and dry yourselves." We stand in the little shed next to her kitchen, drying ourselves with one towel. We stand and shiver and wait, because you can't go marching into her kitchen till she tells you. We hear her inside starting the fire, rattling the poker in the range, then yelling at us, "Are ye got to stand in there all day? Come in here and put on your clothes." She gives us mugs of tea and cuts of fried bread, and we sit at the table eating quietly, because you're not supposed to say a word unless she tells you. Michael asks her for a second cut of fried bread, and we expect her to knock him off the chair for his cheek, but she just grumbles, "'Tis far from two cuts of fried bread ye were brought up," and gives each of us another cut. She tries to feed Alfie bread soaked in tea, but he won't eat it till she sprinkles it with sugar, and when he's finished, he smiles and pees all over her lap, and we're delighted. She runs out to the shed to dab at herself with a towel, and we're able to grin at each other at the table and tell Alfie he's the champion baby in the world. Uncle Pa Keating comes in the door, all black from his job at the gasworks. "OBJ," he says, "what's this?" Michael says, "My mother is in the hospital, Uncle Pa." "Is that so? What's up with her?" "Pneumonia," says Malachi. "Well, now, that's better than old-monia." We don't know what he's laughing at, and Aunt Aggie comes in from the shed and tells him how Mam is in the hospital, and we're to stay with him till she gets out. He says, "Grand, grand," and goes to the shed to wash himself. Though when he comes back, you'd never know he touched himself with water at all. He's that black. He sits at the table, and Aunt Aggie gives him his supper, which is fried bread and ham and sliced tomatoes. She tells us get away from the table and stop gawking at him having his tea, and tells him to stop giving us bits of ham and tomato. He says, "Atta for Jesus' sake, Aggie, the children are hungry." And she says, "'Tis none of your business, they're not yours." She tells us go out and play and be home for bed by 8:30. We know it's freezing outside and we'd like to stay in by that warm range, but it's easier to be in the streets playing than inside with Aunt Aggie and her nagging. She calls me in later and sends me upstairs to borrow a rubber sheet from a woman who had a child that died. The woman says, "Tell your aunt I'd like that rubber sheet back for the next child." Aunt Aggie says, 12 years ago that child died and she still keeps the rubber sheet. 45 she is now, and if there's another child, we'll have to look for a star in the east." Malachi says, "What's that?" and she tells him, mind his own business, he's too young. Aunt Aggie places the rubber sheet on her bed and puts Alfie on it between herself and Uncle Pa. She sleeps inside against the wall and Uncle Pa outside because he has to get up in the morning for work. We are to sleep on the floor against the opposite wall with one coat under us and two over. She says if she hears a word out of us during the night, she'll warm our arses. And we're to be up early in the morning because it's Ash Wednesday, and it wouldn't do us any harm to go to Mass and pray for our poor mother and her pneumonia. The alarm clock shocks us out of our sleep. Aunt Aggie calls from her bed. The three of ye are to get up and go to Mass, do you hear me? Up! Wash your faces and go to the Jesuits. Her backyard is all frost and ice, and our hands stink from the tap water. We throw a little on our faces and dry with a towel that's still damp from yesterday. Malachy whispers our wash was a lick and a promise. That's what Mam would say. The streets are frosty and icy too, but the Jesuit church is warm. Must be grand to be a Jesuit, sleeping in a bed with sheets, blankets, pillows, and getting up to a nice warm house and a warm church with nothing to do but say Mass, hear confessions, and yell at people for their sins, have your meals served up to you, and read your Latin office before you go to sleep. I'd like to be a Jesuit someday, but there's no hope of that when you grow up in a lane. Jesuits are very particular. They don't like poor people. They like people with motor cars who stick out their little fingers when they pick up their teacups. The church is crowded with people at 7 o'clock Mass, getting the ashes on their foreheads. Malachy whispers that Michael shouldn't get the ashes because he won't be making his first communion till May, and it would be a sin. Michael starts to cry, I want the ashes, I want the ashes. An old woman behind us says, what are ye doing to that lovely child? Malachy explains the lovely child never made his first communion, and he's not in a state of grace. Malachy is getting ready for confirmation himself, always showing off his knowledge of the catechism, always going on about state of grace. He won't admit, I knew all about the state of grace a year ago, so long ago I'm starting to forget it. The old woman says, you don't have to be in a state of grace to get a few ashes on your forehead, and tells Malachy stop tormenting his poor little brother. She pats Michael on the head and tells him he's a lovely child and go up there and get your ashes. He runs to the altar, and when he comes back, the woman gives him a penny to go with his ashes. Aunt Aggie is still in the bed with Alfie. She tells Malachy to fill Alfie's bottle with milk and bring it to him. She tells me to start the fire in the range, that there's paper and wood in a box and coal in the coal scuttle. If the fire won't start, sprinkle it with a little paraffin oil. The fire is slow and smoky, and I sprinkle it with the paraffin oil. It flares up, whoosh, and nearly takes my eyebrows off. There's smoke everywhere, and Aunt Aggie rushes into the kitchen. She shoves me away from the range. Jesus above, can't you do anything right? You're supposed to open the damper, you idiot. I don't know anything about dampers. In our house we have a fireplace in Ireland downstairs and a fireplace in Italy upstairs and no sign of a damper. Then you go to your aunt's house and you're supposed to know all about dampers. There's no use telling her this is the first time you ever lit a fire in a range. She'll just give you another thump in the skull and send you flying. It's hard to know why grown-up people get so angry over little things like dampers. When I'm a man, I won't go around thumping small children over dampers or anything else. Now she yells at me, look at Lord Muck standing there. Would you ever think of opening the window and letting out the smoke? Of course you wouldn't. You have a puss on you like your father from the north. Do you think now you can boil the water for the tea without burning the house down? She cuts 3 slices from a loaf, smears them with margarine for us, and goes back to bed. We have the tea and bread, and it's one morning we're glad to go to school where it's warm and there are no yelling aunts. After school, she tells me sit at the table and write my father a letter about Mam in the hospital and how we're all at Aunt Aggie's till Mam comes home. I'm to tell him we're all happy and in the best of health, send money, food is very dear, growing boys eat a lot, ha ha. Alfie the baby needs clothes and nappies. I don't know why she's always angry. Her flat is warm and dry. She has electric light in the house and her own lavatory in the backyard. Uncle Pa has a steady job and he brings home his wages every Friday. He drinks his pints at South's pub but never comes home singing songs of Ireland's long, woeful history. He says, a pox in all their houses. And he says the funniest thing in the world is that we all have arses that have to be wiped and no man escapes that. The minute a politician or a pope starts his blather, Uncle Pa thinks of him wiping his arse. Hitler and Roosevelt and Churchill all wipe their arses, De Valera too. He says the only people you can trust in that department are the Mohammedans, for they eat with one hand and wipe with the other. The human hand itself is a sneaky bugger, and you never know what it's been up to. There are good times with Uncle Pa. When Aunt Aggie goes to the Mechanics Institute to play cards, 45, he says, to hell with the big Rogers. He gets himself 2 bottles of stout from South's, 6 buns and a 1/2 pound of ham from the shop on the corner. He makes tea and we sit by the range drinking it, eating our ham sandwiches and buns and laughing over Uncle Pa and the way he goes on about the world. He says, I swallow the gas, I drink the pint, I don't give a fiddler's fart about the world and its cousin. If little Alfie gets tired and cranky and cries, Uncle Pa pulls his shirt back from his chest and tells him, here, have a suck at Diddy Mama. The sight of that flat chest and the nipple shocks Alfie and makes him good again. Before Aunt Aggie comes home, we have to wash the mugs and clean up so she won't know we were stuffing ourselves with buns and ham sandwiches. She'd nag Uncle Pa for a month if she ever found out, and that's what I don't understand. Why does he let her nag him like that? He went to the Great War, he was gassed, he's big, he has a job, he makes the world laugh. It's a mystery. That's what the priest and the masters tell you. Everything is a mystery, and you have to believe what you're told. I could easily have Uncle Pa for a father. We'd have great times sitting by the fire in the range, drinking tea and laughing over the way he farts and says, light a match, that's a present from the Germans. Aunt Aggie torments me all the time. She calls me scabby eyes. She says I'm the spitting image of my father. I have the odd manner. I have the sneaky air of a northern Presbyterian. I'll probably grow up and build an altar to Oliver Cromwell himself. I'll run off and marry an English tart and cover my house with pictures of the royal family. I want to get away from her, and I can think of only one way, to make myself sick and go to the hospital. I get up in the middle of the night and go to her backyard. I can pretend I'm going to the lavatory. I stand out in the open in the freezing weather and hope I'll catch pneumonia or the galloping consumption, so that I'll go to the hospital with the nice clean sheets and the meals in the bed and books brought by the girl in the blue dress. I might meet another Patricia Madigan and learn a long poem. I stand in the backyard for ages in my shirt and bare feet, looking up at the moon, which is a ghostly galleon riding upon cloudy seas, and go back to bed shivering, hoping I'll wake up in the morning with a terrible cough and flushed cheeks. But I don't. I feel fresh and lively, and I'd be in great form if I could be at home with my mother and brothers. There are days when Aunt Aggie tells us she can't stand the sight of us another minute. Get away from me. Here, scabby eyes, take Alfie out in his pram. Take your brothers, go to the park and play. Do anything you like and don't come back till tea time when the Angelus is ringing. Not a minute later, do you hear me? Not a minute later. It's cold, but we don't care. We push the pram up O'Connell Avenue, out to Ballinacurra or the Ross Bryan Road. We let Alfie crawl around in fields to look at cows and sheep, and we laugh when the cows nuzzle him. I get under the cows and squirt the milk into Alfie's mouth till he's full and throws it up. Farmers chase us till they see how small Michael and Alfie are. Malachy laughs at the farmers. He says, hit me now with the child in my arms. Then he has a great notion. Why can't we go to our own house and play a while? We find twigs and bits of wood in the fields and rush to Roden Lane. There are matches by the fireplace in Italy, and we have a good fire going in no time. Alfie falls asleep, and soon the rest of us drift off till the Angelus booms out of the Redemptorist Church, and we know we're in trouble with Aunt Aggie for being late. We don't care. She can yell at us all she wants, but we had a grand time out the country with the cows and the sheep, and then the lovely fire above in Italy. You can tell she never has grand times like that. Electric light and a lavatory, but no grand times. Grandma comes to her on Thursdays and Sundays, and they take the bus to the hospital to see Mam. We can't go because children are not allowed, and if we say, "How's Mam?" they look cranky and tell us she's all right, she'll live. We'd like to know when she's getting out of hospital so that we can all go back home, but we're afraid to open our mouths. Malachy tells Aunt Aggie one day he's hungry and could he have a piece of bread. She hits him with a rolled-up little messenger of the Sacred Heart and there are tears on his eyelashes. He doesn't come home from school the next day and he's still gone at bedtime. Aunt Aggie says, "Well, I suppose he ran away, good riddance. If he was hungry, he'd be here. Let him find comfort in a ditch." Next day, Michael runs in from the street. "Dad's here, Dad's here," and runs back out, and there's Dad sitting on the hall floor, hugging Michael, crying. "Your poor mother, your poor mother." And there's a smell of drink in him. Aunt Aggie is smiling. "Oh, you're here." And she makes tea and eggs and sausages. She sends me out for a bottle of stout for Dad, and I wonder why she's so pleasant and generous all of a sudden. Michael says, "Are we going to our own house, Dad?" "We are, son." Alfie is back in the pram with the three old coats and coal and wood for the fire. Aunt Aggie stands at her door and tells us, "Be good boys, come back for tea any time," and there's a bad word for her in my head. "Old bitch." It's in my head and I can't help it, and I'll have to tell the priest in confession. Malachy isn't in a ditch. He's there in our own house eating fish and chips a drunken soldier dropped at the gate of the Sarchville barracks. Mam comes home in 2 days. She's weak and white and walks slowly. She says, "The doctor told me keep warm, have plenty of rest and nourishing food. Meat and eggs 3 times a week. God help us. Those poor doctors don't have a notion of not having." Dad makes tea and toasts bread for her on the fire. He fries bread for the rest of us, and we have a lovely night up in Italy where it's warm. He says he can't stay forever. He has to go back to work in Coventry. Mam wonders how he'll get to Coventry without a penny in his pocket. He's up early on Holy Saturday and I have tea with him by the fire. He fries 4 cuts of bread and wraps them in pages of the Limerick Chronicle, 2 cuts in each coat pocket. Mam is still in bed and he calls to her from the bottom of the stairs. "I'm going now." She says, "All right, right when you land." My father is going to England and she won't even get out of the bed. I ask if I can go with him to the railway station. No, he's not going there. He's going to the Dublin Road to see if he can get a lift. He pats my head, tells me take care of my mother and brothers, and goes out the door. I watch him go up the lane till he turns the corner. I run up the lane to see him go down Barrack Hill and down St. Joseph Street. I run down the hill and follow him as far as I can. He must know I'm following him, because he turns and calls to me. "Go home, Francis. Go home to your mother." In a week there's a letter to say he arrived safely, that we're to be good boys, attend to our religious duties, and above all, obey our mother. In another week there's a telegram money order for £3, and we're in heaven. We'll be rich. There will be fish and chips, jelly and custard, films every Saturday at the Lyric, the Coliseum, the Carlton, the Athenaeum, the Central, and the fanciest of all, the Savoy. We might even wind up having tea and cakes at the Savoy Cafe with the knobs and toffs of Limerick. We'll be sure to hold our teacups with our little fingers sticking out. The next Saturday, there's no telegram. nor the Saturday after, nor any Saturday forever. Ma'am begs again at the St. Vincent de Paul Society and smiles at the dispensary when Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane have their bit of a joke about Dad having a tart in Piccadilly. Michael wants to know what a tart is, and she tells him it's something you have with tea. She spends most of the day by the fire with Bridie Hannon puffing on her woodbines, drinking weak tea. The breadcrumbs from the morning are always on the table when we come home from school. She never washes the jam jars or mugs, and there are flies in the sugar and wherever there is sweetness. She says Maliki and I have to take turns looking after Alfie, taking him out in the pram for a bit of fresh air. The child can't be kept in Italy from October to April. If we tell her we want to play with our pals, she might let fly with a right cross to the head that stings the ears. We play games with Alfie and the pram. I stand at the top of Barrack Hill and Maliki is at the bottom. When I give the pram a push down the hill, Maliki is supposed to stop it, but he is looking at a pal on roller skates and it speeds by him across the street and through the doors of Leniston's pub, where men are having a peaceful pint and not expecting a pram with a dirty-faced child saying, "Goo, goo, goo, goo." The barman shouts, "This is a disgrace. There must be a law against this class of behaviour. Babies roaring through the door in buckety prams. He'll call the guards on us." And Alfie waves at him and smiles, and he says, "All right, all right. The child can have a sweet and a lemonade. The brothers can have a lemonade too, that raggedy pair. And God above, 'tis a hard world. The minute you think you're getting ahead, a pram comes crashing through the door and you're dishing out sweets and lemonade right and left. The two of ye, take that child and go home to your mother." Maliki has another powerful idea, that we could go around Limerick like tinkers, pushing Alfie in his pram into pubs for the sweets and lemonade. "But I don't want Mam finding out and hitting me with her right cross." Maliki says, "I'm not a sport," and runs off. I push the pram over to Henry Street and up by the Redemptorist Church. It's a grey day. The church is grey, and the small crowd of people outside the door of the priest's house is grey. They're waiting to beg for any food left over from the priest's dinner. There in the middle of the crowd, in her dirty grey coat, is my mother. This is my own mother begging. This is worse than the dole, the St. Vincent de Paul Society, the dispensary. It's the worst kind of shame, almost as bad as begging on the streets where the tinkers hold up their scabby children. "Give us a penny for the poor child, mister. The poor child is hungry, missus." My mother is a beggar now. And if anyone from the lane or my school sees her, the family will be disgraced entirely. My pals will make up new names and torment me in the schoolyard, and I know what they'll say. "Frankie McCourt, beggar woman's boy, scabby eye, dancing, blubbergob jap." The door of the priest's house swings open and the people rush with their hands out. I can hear them. "Brother, brother, here, brother. Ah, for the love of God, brother. 5 children at home, brother." I can see my own mother pushed along. I can see the tightness of her mouth when she snatches at a bag and turns from the door. And I push the pram up the street before she can see me. I don't want to go home anymore. I push the pram down to the dock road, out to Cork and Rea, where all the dust and garbage of Limerick is dumped and burned. I stand a while and look at boys chase rats. I don't know why they have to torture rats that are not in their houses. I'd keep going on into the country forever if I didn't have Alfie bawling with the hunger, kicking his chubby legs, waving his empty bottle. Mam has the fire going and something boiling in a pot. Maliki smiles and says she brought home corned beef and a few spuds from Kathleen O'Connell's shop. He wouldn't be so happy if he knew he was the son of a beggar. She calls us in from the lane, and when we sit at the table, it's hard for me to look at my mother, the beggar. She lifts the pot to the table, spoons out the potatoes, one each, and uses a fork to lift out the corned beef. It isn't corned beef at all. It's a great lump of quivering grey fat, and the only sign of corned beef is a little nipple of red meat on top. We stare at that bit of meat and wonder who will get it. Mam says, "That's for Alfie. He's a baby. He's growing fast. He needs it." She puts it on a saucer in front of him. He pushes it away with his finger, then pulls it back. He lifts it to his mouth, looks around the kitchen, sees Lucky the dog, and throws it to him. There's no use saying anything. The meat is gone. We eat our potatoes with plenty of salt, and I eat my fat, and pretend it's that nipple of red meat. Mam warns us, "Ye are to keep your paws out of that trunk, for there's nothing in there that's of the slightest interest, or any of your business." All she has in that trunk is a lot of papers, certificates of birth and baptism, her Irish passport, Dad's English passport from Belfast, our American passports, and her bright red flapper dress with spangles and black frills she brought all the way from America. She wants to keep that dress forever, to remind herself she was young and dancing. I don't care what she has in the trunk, till I start a football team with Billy Campbell and Malachi. We can't afford uniforms or boots, and Billy says, "How will the world know who we are? We don't even have a name." I remember the red dress, and a name comes to me, the Red Hearts of Limerick. Mam never opens the trunk. So what does it matter if I cut off a piece of the dress to make 7 red hearts we can stick on our chests? "What you don't know won't bother you," she always says herself. The dress is buried under the papers. I look at my passport picture when I was small, and I can see why they call me Jap. There's a paper that says, "Marriage Certificate," that Malachy McCourt and Angela Sheehan were joined in holy matrimony on the 28th of March, 1930. How could that be? I was born on the 19th of August, and Billy Campbell told me the father and mother have to be married 9 months before there's a sign of a child. Here I am, born into the world in half the time. That means I must be a miracle. And I might grow up to be a saint with people celebrating the feast of St. Francis of Limerick. I'll have to ask Mikey Malloy, still the expert on girls' bodies and dirty things in general. Billy says if we're to be great soccer players, we have to practice, and we're to meet over in the park. The boys complain when I hand out their hearts, and I tell them if they don't like it, they can go home and cut up their own mother's dresses and blouses. We have no money for a proper ball, so one of the boys brings a sheep's bladder stuffed with rags. We kick the bladder up and down the meadow till there are holes, and rags start falling out, and we get fed up kicking a bladder that's hardly there anymore. Billy says we're to meet tomorrow morning, which is Saturday, and go out Ballinacora to see if we can challenge Rich Crescent College boys to a proper game, 7-a-side. He says we're to pin our red hearts to our shirts, even if they're red rags. Malachy is going home for tea, but I can't go because I have to see Mikey Malloy and find out why I was born in half the time. Mikey is coming out of his house with his father, Peter. It's Mikey's 16th birthday, and his father is taking him to Bowles' pub for his first pint. Nora Malloy is inside, screeching after Peter that if they go, they can stay gone. She's done baking bread. She's never going to the lunatic asylum again. If he brings that child home drunk, she'll go to Scotland and disappear from the face of the earth. Peter tells Mikey, "Pay no attention to her, Cyclops. The mothers of Ireland are always enemies of the first pint. My own mother tried to kill my father with a frying pan when he took me for the first pint." Mikey asks Peter if I can come with him and have a lemonade. Peter tells everyone in the pub that Mikey is there for his first pint. And when all the men want to stand Mikey a pint, Peter says, "I know, 'twould be a terrible thing if he had too much and turned against it entirely." The pints are drawn, and we sit against the wall. the Malloys with their pints, and I with my lemonade. The men wish Mikey all the best in the life to come. And wasn't it a gift from God that he fell off that spout years ago and never had the fit since? And wasn't it a great pity about that poor little bugger Quasimodo Dooley, carried off with the consumption, after all his trouble talking for years like an Englishman so he could be on the BBC, which is no fit place for an Irishman anyway? Peter is talking to the men, and Mikey, sipping his first pint, whispers to me, "I don't think I like it, but don't tell my father." Then he tells me how he practices the English accent in secret so that he can be a BBC announcer, Quasimodo's dream. He tells me I can have Cahoolan back, that he's no use to you when you're reading the news on the BBC. Now that he's 16, he wants to go to England, and if ever I get a wireless, that would be him on the BBC Home Service. I tell him about the marriage certificate, how Billy Campbell said it has to be 9 months, but I was born in half the time, and would he know if I was some class of a miracle? "Nah," he says, "nah. You're a bastard. You're doomed." "You don't have to be cursing me, Mikey." "I'm not. That's what they call people who aren't born inside the 9 months of the marriage, people conceived beyond the blanket." "What's that?" "What's what?" "Conceived. That's when the sperm hits the egg and it grows, and there you are, 9 months later." "I don't know what you're talking about." He whispers, "The thing between your legs is the excitement. I don't like the other names, the dong, the prick, the dick, the langer. So your father shoves his excitement into your mother, and there's a spurt, and these little germs go up into your mother where there's an egg, and that grows into you." "I'm not an egg." "You are an egg. Everyone was an egg once." "Why am I doomed? 'Tisn't my fault I'm a bastard." "All bastards are doomed. They're like babies that weren't baptized. They're sent to limbo for eternity, and there's no way out, and it's not their fault. It makes you wonder about God up there in his throne with no mercy for the little unbaptized babies. That's why I don't go near the chapel anymore. Anyway, you're doomed. Your father and mother had the excitement, and they weren't married, so you're not in a state of grace." "What am I going to do?" "Nothing. You're doomed." "Can't I light a candle or something?" "Oh, you could try the Blessed Virgin. She's in charge of the doom." "But I don't have a penny for the candle." "All right, all right, here's a penny. You can give it back when you get a job a million years from now. 'Tis costing me a fortune to be the expert on girls' bodies and dirty things in general." The barman is doing a crossword puzzle, and he says to Peter, "What's the opposite of advance?" "Retreat," says Peter. "That's it," said the barman. "Everything has an opposite." "Mother of God," says Peter. "What's up with you, Peter?" says the barman. "What was it you said before, Tommy?" "Everything has an opposite." "Mother of God!" "Are you all right, Peter? Is the pint all right?" "The pint is grand, Tommy, and I'm the champion of all pint drinkers, am't I?" "Begotten you are, Peter, no denying that to you." "That means I could be the champion in the opposite department." "What are you talking about, Peter?" "I could be the champion of no pints at all." "Ah, now, Peter, I think you're going a bit far. Is the wife all right at home?" "Tommy, take this pint away from me. I'm the champion of no pints at all." Peter turns and takes the glass from Mikey. "We're going home to your mother, Mikey." "You didn't call me Cyclops, Dad." "You're Mikey. You're Michael. We're going to England. No more pints for me. No pints for you. No more bread baking for your mother. Come on." We're leaving the pub, and Tommy the barman calls after us, "You know what 'tis, Peter? 'Tis all them bloody books you read and they have your head destroyed." Peter and Mikey turned to go home. I have to go to St. Joseph's to light the candle that will save me from the doom. But I look in the window of Coonahan's shop, and there in the middle is a great slab of Cleve's toffee and a sign, "Two pieces for a penny." I know I'm doomed, but the water is running along the sides of my tongue. When I put my penny on the counter for Miss Coonahan, I promise the Virgin Mary, the next penny I get, I'll be lighting a candle. And would she please talk to her son and delay the doom for a while? A penn'orth of Cleve's toffee doesn't last forever. And when it's gone, I have to think of going home to a mother who let my father push his excitement into her so that I could be born in half the time and grow up to be a bastard. If she ever says a word about the red dress or anything, I'll tell her I know all about the excitement, and she'll be shocked. Saturday morning, I meet the Red Hearts of Limerick, and we wander out the road looking for a football challenge. The boys are still grousing that the bits of red dress don't look like hearts, till Billy tells them, if they don't want to play football, go home and play with their sister's dolls. There are boys playing football in a field in Ballinacurra, and Billy challenges them. They have 8 players, and we have only 7, but we don't mind because one of them has one eye, and Billy tells us stay on his blind side. Besides, he says, Frankie McCourt is nearly blind with his 2 bad eyes, and that's worse. They're all togged out in blue and white jerseys, and white shorts, and proper football boots. One of them says, we look like something the cat brought in, and Malachy has to be held back from fighting them. We agreed to play half an hour because the Ballinacurra boys say they have to go to lunch. Lunch? The whole world has dinner in the middle of the day, but they have lunch. If no one scores in half an hour, it's a draw. We play back and forth till Billy gets the ball and goes speeding and dancing up the sideline so fast no one can catch him, and in goes the ball for a goal. The half hour is nearly up, but the Ballinacurra boys want another half hour, and they manage to score well into the second half hour. Then the ball goes over the line for touch. It's our ball. Billy stands on the touchline with the ball over his head. He pretends to look at Malachy, but throws the ball to me. It comes to me as if it's the only thing that exists in the whole world. It comes straight to my foot, and all I have to do is swivel to the left and swing that ball straight into the goal. There's a whiteness in my head, and I feel like a boy in heaven. I'm floating over the whole field till the Red Hearts of Limerick clap me on the back and tell me that was a great goal, Frankie. You too, Billy. We walk back along O'Connell Avenue, and I keep thinking of the way the ball came to my foot. And surely it was sent by God or the Blessed Virgin Mary, who would never send such a blessing to one doomed for being born in half the time. And I know as long as I live, I'll never forget that ball coming from Billy Campbell. That goal. Mam meets Bridie Hannon and her mother going up the lane, and they tell her about Mr. Hannon's poor legs. Poor John, it's a trial for him to cycle home every night after delivering coal and turf all day on the great float for the coal merchants on the dock road. He's paid from 8 in the morning till 5:30 in the evening, though he has to get the horse ready well before 8 and settle him for the night well after 5:30. He's up and down on that float all day, hoisting bags of coal and turf, desperate to keep the bandages in place on his legs so the dirt won't get into the open sores. The bandages are forever sticking and have to be ripped away. And when he comes home, she washes the sores with warm water and soap, covers them with ointment and wraps them in clean bandages. They can't afford new bandages every day, so she keeps washing the old ones over and over till they're grey. Mam says Mr. Hannon should see the doctor, and Mrs. Hannon says, sure, he's seen the doctor a dozen times, and the doctor says he has to stay off them legs. That's all. Stay off them legs. Sure, how can he stay off them legs? He has to work. What would we live on if he didn't work? Mam says Bridie could get some kind of a job herself, and Bridie is offended. Don't you know I have a weak chest, Angela? Don't you know I had rheumatic fever and I could go at any time? I have to be careful. Mam often talks about Bridie and her rheumatic fever and weak chest. She says, that one is able to sit here by the hour and complain about her ailments, but it doesn't stop her from puffing away in the woodbines. Mam tells Bridie she's very sorry over the weak chest, and it's terrible the way her father suffers. Mrs. Hannan tells my mother that John is getting worse every day.
And what would you think, Mrs. McCourt, if your boy Frankie went on the float with him a few hours a week and helped him with the bags? We can barely afford it, but Frankie could earn a shilling or two and John could rest his poor legs.
Mam says, I don't know. He's only 11, and he had that typhoid and the coal dust wouldn't be good for his eyes. Bridie says, he'd be out in the air, and there's nothing like fresh air for someone with bad eyes or getting over the typhoid. Isn't that right, Frankie?
Tis, Bridie.
I'm dying to go around with Mr. Hannan on the great float like a real working man. If I'm good at it, they might let me stay at home from school forever, but Mam says he can do it as long as it doesn't interfere with school, and he can start on a Saturday morning. I'm a man now, so I light the fire early on Saturday morning and make my own tea and fried bread. I wait next door for Mr. Hannan to come out with his bicycle, and there's a lovely smell of rashers and eggs coming through the window. Mam says Mr. Hannan gets the best of food because Mrs. Hannan is as mad about him as she was the day she married him. They're like two lovers out of an American film the way they go on. Here he is pushing the bicycle and puffing away on the pipe in his mouth. He tells me, climb up in the bar of his bike and off we go to my first job as a man. His head is over mine on the bike and the smell of the pipe is lovely. There's a cold smell on his clothes and that makes me sneeze. Men are walking or cycling toward the coal yards and Rank's flour mills and the Limerick Steamship Company on the dock road. Mr. Hannan takes his pipe from his mouth and tells me, this is the best morning of all, Saturday, half day. We'll start at 8 and be finished by the time the Angelus rings at 12. First we get the horse ready, give him a bit of a rub, fill the wooden tub with oats and the bucket with water. Mr. Hannan shows me how to put on the harness and lets me back the horse into the shafts of the float. He says, ah, Jesus, Frankie, you have the knack of it. That makes me so happy I want to jump up and down and drive a float the rest of my life. There are two men filling bags with coal and turf and weighing them on the great iron scale, 100 weight in each bag. It's their job to stack the bags on the float while Mr. Hannan goes to the office for the delivery dockets. The bagmen are fast and we're ready for our rounds. Mr. Hannan sits up on the left side of the float and flicks the whip to show where I'm to sit on the right side. It's hard to climb up the way the float is so high and packed with bags, and I try to get up by climbing the wheel. Mr. Hannan says, I should never do the likes of that again. Never put your leg or hand near a wheel when the horse is harnessed in the shafts. A horse might take a notion to go for a walk for himself, and there you are with the leg or arm caught in the wheel and twisted off your body, and you looking at it. He says to the horse, "Gut bar that." And the horse shakes his head and rattles the harness, and Mr. Hannan laughs. That fool of a horse loves to work, he says. He won't be rattling his harness in a few hours. When the rain starts, we cover ourselves with old coal bags, and Mr. Hannan turns his pipe upside down in his mouth to keep the tobacco dry. He says the rain makes everything heavier, but what's the use of complaining? You might as well complain about the sun in Africa. We cross the Sarsfield Bridge for deliveries to the Ennis Road and the North Circular Road. Rich people, says Mr. Hannan, and very slow to put their hands in their pockets for a tip. We have 16 bags to deliver. Mr. Hannan says we're lucky today because some houses get more than one, and he doesn't have to be climbing on and off that float destroying his legs. When we stop, he gets down, and I pull the bag to the edge and lay it on his shoulders. Some houses have areas outside where you pull up a trapdoor and tip the bag till it empties. That's easy. There are other houses with long backyards,
and you could see Mr. Hannan suffering with his legs when he has to carry the bags from the floor to the sheds near the back doors. Ah, Jesus, Frankie, ah, Jesus, is the only complaint out of him. And he asked me to give him a hand to climb back on the floor. He says if he had a handcart, he could wheel the bags from floor to house, and that would be a blessing. But a handcart would cost 2 weeks' wages. Who could afford that? The bags are delivered, and the sun is out, the float is empty, and the horse knows his work day is over. It's lovely to sit on the float looking along the length of the horse, from his tail to his head, rocking along the Innes Road, over the Shannon and up the Dock Road. Mr. Hannan says the man who delivered 1,600 wits of coal and turf deserves a pint, and the boy who helped him deserves a lemonade. He tells me I should go to school and not be like him, working away with the two legs rotting under him. Go to school, Frankie, and get out of Limerick and Ireland itself. This war will be over some day, and you can go to America or Australia or any big open country where you can look up and see no end to the land. The world is wide, and you can have great adventures. If I didn't have these two legs, I'd be over in England making a fortune in the factories like the rest of the Irishmen.
Like your father.
No, not like your father. I hear he left you high and dry, huh? I don't know how a man in his right mind can go off and leave a wife and family to starve and shiver in a Limerick winter. School, Frankie. School. The books. The books. The books. Get out of Limerick before your legs rot and your mind collapses entirely. The horse clops along, and when we get to the coal yard, we feed and water him and give him a rub down. Mr. Hannan talks to him all the time and calls him, me old Sir Gosha. And the horse snuffles and pushes his nose against Mr. Hannan's chest. I'd love to bring this horse home and let him stay downstairs when we're up in Italy. But even if I could get him in the door, my mother would yell at me that the last thing we need in this house is a horse. The streets going up from the Dock Road are too hilly for Mr. Hannan to ride the bicycle and carry me, so we walk. His legs are sore from the day, and it takes a long time to get up to Henry Street. He leans on the bicycle or sits on the steps outside houses, grinding down on the pipe in his mouth. I'm wondering when I'll get the money for the day's work, because Mam might let me go to the Lyric Cinema if I get home in time with my shilling, or whatever Mr. Hannan gives me. Now we're at the door of South's pub and he tells me, come in. Didn't he promise me a lemonade? Uncle Pat Keating is sitting in the pub. He's all black as usual, and he's sitting next to Bill Galvin, all white as usual, snuffling and taking great slugs out of his black pint. Mr. Hannan says, how are you? And sits on the other side of Bill Galvin, and everyone in the pub laughs. Jesus, says the barman, look at that. Two lumps of coal and a snowball. Men come in from other parts of the pub to see the two coal black men with the lime white man in the middle, and they want to send down to the Limerick leader for a man with a camera. Uncle Pa says, what are you doing all black yourself, Frankie? Did you fall down a coal mine?
I was helping Mr. Hannan on the floor.
Your eyes look atrocious, Frankie. Piss holes in the snow.
'Tis the coal dust, Uncle Pa.
Wash them when you go home.
I will, Uncle Pa.
Mr. Hannan buys me a lemonade, gives me the shilling for my morning's work, and tells me I can go home now. I'm a great worker, and I can help him again next week after school. On the way home, I see myself in the glass of a shop window, all black from the coal, and I feel like a man with a shilling in his pocket. A man who had a lemonade in a pub with two coal men and a lime man. I'm not a child anymore, and I could easily leave Leamy School forever. I could work with Mr. Hannan every day, and when his legs got too bad, I could take over the float and deliver coal to the rich people the rest of my life. And my mother wouldn't have to be a beggar at the Redemptorist Priest's house. People on the streets and lanes give me curious looks, Boys and girls laugh and call out, "Here's the chimney sweep. How much do you want for cleaning our chimney? Did you fall into a coal hole? Were you burned by the darkness?"
They're ignorant. They don't know I spent the day delivering hundredweights of coal and turf. They don't know I'm a man.
Mam is sleeping up in Italy with Alfie, and there's a coat over the window to keep the room dark. I tell her I earned a shilling, and she says I can go to the Lyric, I deserve it. Take tuppence and leave the rest of the shilling on the mantelpiece downstairs so that she can send out for a loaf of bread for the tea. The coat suddenly drops from the window, and the room is bright. Mam looks at me.
"God above, look at your eyes. Go downstairs and I'll be down in a minute to wash them."
She heats water in the kettle and dabs at my eyes with boric acid powder and tells me I can't go to the Lyric Cinema today or any day till my eyes clear up, though God knows when that will be. She says,
"You can't be delivering coal with the state of your eyes. The dust would surely destroy them."
I want the job. I want to bring home the shilling. I want to be a man.
You can be a man without bringing home a shilling. Go upstairs and lie down and rest your two eyes, or it's a blind man you'll be.
I want that job. I wash my eyes 3 times a day with the boric acid powder. I remember Seamus in the hospital and how his uncle's eyes were cured with the blink exercise, and I make sure to sit and blink for an hour every day.
"You can't beat the blink for the strong eye," he said.
And now I blink and blink, till Malachy runs to my mother, talking out in the lane with Mrs. Hannan.
"Ma'am, something is up with Frankie. He's upstairs blinking and blinking."
She comes running up.
"What's wrong with you?"
"I'm making my eyes strong with the exercise."
"What exercise?"
"The blinking."
"Blinking is not exercise."
"Seamus in the hospital says you can't beat the blink for the strong eye. His uncle had powerful eyes from the blinking." She says I'm getting odd and goes back to the lane in her chat with Mrs. Hannan. And I blink and bathe my eyes with the boric acid powder in warm water. I can hear Mrs. Hannan through the window.
"Your little Frankie is a godsend to John, for 'tis the climbing up and down in that float that was ruining his legs entirely."
Mam doesn't say anything, and that means she feels so sorry for Mr. Hannan, she let me help him again on his heavy delivery day, Thursday. I wash my eyes 3 times a day, and I blink till I get a pain in my eyebrows. I blink in school when the master isn't looking, and all the boys in my class are calling me Blinky and adding that to the list of names.
"Blinky McCourt, beggar woman's son, scabby-eyed blubber-gob dancing Jap."
I don't care what they call me anymore, as long as my eyes are clearing up and I have a regular job lifting 100 weights of coal on a float. I wish they could see me on Thursday after school when I'm on the float and Mr. Hannan hands me the reins so that he can smoke his pipe in comfort.
"Here you are, Frankie. Nice and gentle, for this is a good horse and he doesn't need to be pulled at."
He hands me the whip too, but you never need the whip with this horse. It's all for show. And I just flick it at the air like Mr. Hannan, or I might knock a fly off the horse's great golden rump, swinging between the shafts. Surely the world is looking at me and admiring the way I rock with the float, the cool way I have with the reins and the whip. I wish I had a pipe like Mr. Hannan and a tweed cap. I wish I could be a real coal man with black skin like Mr. Hannan and Uncle Pa Keating, so that people would say,
"There goes Frankie McCourt that delivers all the coal in Limerick and drinks his pint in South's pub."
I'd never wash my face. I'd be black every day of the year, even Christmas, when you're supposed to give yourself a good wash for the coming of the infant Jesus. I know he wouldn't mind, because I saw the 3 wise men in the Christmas crib at the Redemptorist Church, and one of them was blacker than Uncle Pa Keating, the blackest man in Limerick. And if a wise man is black, it means that everywhere you go in the world, someone is delivering coal. The horse lifts his tail, and great lumps of steaming yellow shit drop from his behind. I start to pull on the reins so that he can stop and have a bit of comfort for himself, but Mr. Hannah says, "No, Frankie, let him trot. They always shit on the trot. That's one of the blessings horses have. They shit on the trot. And they're not dirty and stinking like the human race, not at all, Frankie. The worst thing in the world is to go into a lavatory after a man that had a feed of pig's feet and a night of pints. The stink from that could twist the nostrils of a